This is the state of things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. Look at the class schedule of any ambitious high school student in North Carolina, and you're likely to see at least one or two classes marked by the initials AP. The AP stands for Advanced Placement, and it indicates that the class will prepare the student to take a national AP test in the spring. The College Board, that's the same organization that runs the SAT, offers AP tests in 34 subjects, from chemistry to English to psychology. In many high schools, AP classes are the most rigorous courses available, and some universities give college credit to students who pass the exams. The AP is popular with students and with parents, and the state of North Carolina has put money into expanding the program here. At the same time, some independent schools in North Carolina and elsewhere are choosing not to offer AP courses to their students, believing their teachers can teach the subject better. Today, we're talking about the AP program in North Carolina, and we're welcoming your calls as always, 1-877-962-9862. College students, have the AP classes you took in high school prepared you for college? And what about you high school students? Do you feel challenged in your AP classes? And then parents, we'd like to know if you're happy with the AP courses that your school offers your children. We're joined in the studio today by Ted Fisk. Ted Fisk is an education writer and author of The Fisk Guide to College. Welcome back to the program, Ted.
Glad to be here, Rusty.
So some independent schools are dropping AP courses, but for the great majority of public schools in North Carolina, AP tests are considered the best thing going. Let's start off by asking you, what's so attractive about the AP program for public schools?
Well, there are two forces behind the phenomenal growth in AP courses. There are now over a million students who take AP tests, and they take more than 2 million of the tests. A lot of students, of course, take more than one AP course. The first push is the desire to increase the academic rigor of American high schools. It's well known American high school students don't do all that well on international comparisons. So there's a big movement to enhance the rigor of what's taught in American high schools. And the academic rigor of the high school program research shows is the best predictor of success in college. The other thing that's forcing it is that from the point of view of the consumer, from the point of view of the student trying to get into college, that having a lot of AP courses on your record is supposedly going to give you a leg up in getting into the school that you want to get into.
So enhancing rigor and also enhancing possibilities of getting into the college of your choice. Quickly, I'm just curious, is the AP helping people reach those goals? Is it doing what what people believe it's supposed to do?
Well, it certainly does. I mean, from the point of view of the colleges, you can what colleges want to see is that you've challenged yourself. And then you've done well. So you've taken the most rigorous courses you can, and then you've done well in those courses. So AP is a way of sending signals to the college. Hey, I'm going to be taking the most rigorous courses I can. Now, there's problems here because there are students in a lot of schools, particularly in low-income areas, where they don't have that many AP courses. So there's a social equity issue here as to whether this is a good system or not.
And I just want a quick look at the history of the AP, and then I'd like to introduce someone else into the conversation. It was started in 1955, I think, by the College Board, same company that administers the SAT. What exactly is the College Board, and why did they get into the business?
Yeah, the College Board is an organization. It's an association of colleges and high schools, although it tends to be balanced more. The colleges tend to have more power in the organization. And it came into being near the beginning of the last century to facilitate the movement from high school to college. So they, in addition to the SAT, which is, of course, what they're most famous for, they publish a lot of information on how to get through into college, on financial aid. Their website is collegeboard.org, and it's a good source of information for anybody on the college admissions. The reason that the AP started was in the 50s was it was a very small program, and it came out of elite high schools, and it was a way of letting students coming out of very rigorous academic programs show to colleges that they don't have to take introductory courses. So it was a way that really good students from good schools didn't have to repeat the same material they'd already had.
We're talking today about the use of AP classes in North Carolina high schools and in college admissions. And as we stated, some schools, independent schools, are actually dropping AP courses. And I'd like to introduce someone into the conversation who can talk about that. Anthony Clay has taught AP courses in U.S. history and government. He's now a college counselor at the Carolina Friends School, an independent school that chooses not to offer AP courses at all. Anthony Clay, welcome.
It's good to be with you, Rusty. Hello, Ted.
Hi.
Why doesn't Carolina Friends School offer AP courses to students, Anthony Clay?
I think there are a couple of primary reasons, Rusty. One beginning with the philosophical underpinnings of this Quaker institution that speak to the individual gifts within each student and within each faculty member. And so there's a tremendous degree of teacher autonomy here and a concern about meeting students where they are and helping them move forward. And so we hope that we're able to tailor a particular course to the strengths and needs of the students within that course. And the pressure to teach to a test in the AP system can be pretty significant, explicitly and implicitly. And I think my colleagues feel very strongly about avoiding those temptations while still challenging students with tremendous rigor in classes without an AP designation.
Ted Fisk, this is the same kind of debate we're seeing with accountability tests and the idea of just getting preparing students to pass tests and not necessarily grow intellectually.
Yeah, that's right. The whole question of teaching to the test. And Pete, there's a growing, as you mentioned, there's a growing number of mainly independent schools that are resisting this. There was at the last meeting, a conference of education admissions officers and counselors in Milwaukee last fall. There was a support group which had a meeting. It attracted about 40 schools to talk about alternatives to the AP. And the feeling is that any good teacher understands that the best kind of learning is where the student is, where it's hands-on, where the student is assimilating information and digesting it, and that a teacher-driven, curriculum-driven approach simply isn't with the kind of thing they want to do. They don't recognize that as the highest quality of teaching and learning that can go on.
Now, I'd like to bring a caller into the conversation, but first I wanted to ask you, Anthony Clay. Now, you yourself have taught AP courses. I'd like you to just tell us, is that something you valued as a teacher? And having taken your teaching experience, how do you feel about the school's decision not to offer the courses?
Well, I loved being an AP teacher. Two subjects, as you noted, U.S. history and U.S. government and politics, at two previous schools, one private, one public, and it was wonderful to have a group of young people who chose to be in a demanding course because of their interest in the subject and their willingness to work hard and to stretch themselves. And so the ability to teach to students' interest and to do that in depth and with a great degree of high-level expectations is wonderful. And I think that that's easier said than done in certain of the AP subjects and in certain high schools, depending on the school climate. I just think that that is not the only model. The AP curriculum and the AP exams are not the only model that can be successful in expecting a great deal of students and in educating them to high-level thinking and a great deal of impressive content.
Ted Fisk?
I think critics would say that all AP courses are not alike. The quality of the course varies widely from course to course. For a number of years, there's been a lot of criticism of the AP Calculus course, which became famous from the movie Stand and Deliver. Remember Jaime Escalante at, what was it, Garland? High school, Garfield High School, out in California, and he took a group of low-income students and said, "You're going to do it." And then there was an issue about some cheating, but they ended up doing very well on the test. Well, that particular calculus course, a lot of mathematicians think is just not really college level. It's just too much moving from step to step. It really doesn't get at the conceptual.
On the other hand, you have AP English or other courses that are highly valued.
Yeah. So the quality of AP courses varies a lot.
We have an AP tutor on the line. Francis is calling from Raleigh. Hi, Francis.
How are you this afternoon?
Fine, thanks very much. What's on your mind?
I've done some tutoring in the Wake County school systems, and another use of the AP course is to segregate the disruptive malcontents in the school body from those students who really want to learn. It's almost, instead of having detention hall, you salvage those children who are eager to learn and motivated to learn, whose parents assist them in learning, and you put them in a class where they can learn, and you take the ruffians and the brutes and you keep them at bay. And I think that in and of itself is invaluable.
Thanks, Francis, for the call. Anthony Clay, is there something to Francis's take on the value of the AP course? Is, segregating, in a sense, the students who want to focus on learning and don't want to be disruptive?
I think there is, to the extent that highly motivated students with a particular interest and talent in a given subject area then can move perhaps deeper and faster than would otherwise be the case. But I have to say that I worry about the flip side of that, which intimates that we're going to give up on those ruffians, those brutes who at that particular moment don't seem to be able to perform at that high level. I worry about that. I don't think that bodes well, that kind of mentality, for the future of those individuals or us as a society.
Ted Fiske, caller put it in perhaps harsh terms, too harsh for some people. I don't know. What's your take?
Right. Well, as AP has become more and more popular, there is an equity issue that's been raised. And do students in particularly large urban schools that serve poor students have access to AP. And so the College Board, to its credit, has made a big effort in recent years to expand the number of AP courses in low-income schools serving low-income students. There is money in the No Child Left Behind Act to do this.
Great. This is The State of Things. We're talking today about AP classes and AP testing in North Carolina, joined by Ted Fiske, education writer and editor, Anthony Clay of Carolina Friends, and we're also going to take a call in just a bit from someone whose school values AP courses. 1-877-962-9862. Join the conversation. Did you take AP classes? Did they help you get into college? Just ahead, a director of admissions at UNC Chapel Hill weighs in. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and listeners who support WUNC. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. We're talking today about the AP, or Advanced Placement Program, in North Carolina high schools. The College Board, the same organization that runs the SAT, created the AP program in 1955. There are now AP courses in 34 subjects, from computer science to psychology to European history. Although some independent schools have recently dropped AP classes from their course offerings, most public schools in North Carolina see AP as a central part of the process of preparing high school students for college. With us in the studio today is Ted Fiske, education writer and editor. Ted Fiske is also the author of The Fiske Guide to College, and we're taking your calls, 1-877-962-9862. And I'd like to bring Pam Heath into the conversation now. She coordinates the AP incentive grant at Lenoir County Schools, a grant that has expanded AP testing across the state, in some cases through AP courses taught online. Hi, Pam Heath. Oh, sorry about that, Pam Heath. I had to press the line to get you on. Are you there?
I'm here.
Great. So you've expanded AP with online courses. Why is AP so important to you and the Lenoir County schools?
Well, what we have seen in our system, 3 years ago, we were allowed to process some information and that we had received from DPI, and there were 35 low-wealth systems in the state that could participate in this grant to offer the AP online courses. We have three high schools here in our system, and the different schools, because of their sizes, they offer, one of the schools offers three AP courses, another one offers six, and another one offers seven. So we saw it as a chance to expand our AP course offerings here in Lenoir County. And we knew that with teacher allocations the way they are, with the AP incentive grant, we could have very small classes, and you won't have to free up a teacher. You have to have a facilitator for those courses. And you have to be, of course, selective about your facilitator, and you have to be selective about the students that go in these courses, because they have to be pretty self-motivated. A student that normally would participate in a regular AP course might not be able to handle the independence of these online courses. And we've been very successful for the past 3 years. We were one of 13 systems in the state that was selected to receive this grant.
Pam, we had a caller before who suggested there's a benefit to the AP courses in kind of giving a place devoted only to the students who are serious and getting, kind of eliminating the influence of more disruptive students. Any truth to that? in your experience?
I wouldn't say. I heard the comments, and I wouldn't say necessarily in that vein. But what we offer, one of our high schools is also an IB high school. They offer international baccalaureate courses. So we see this just as another chance to offer courses. And I can say, too, as a parent, both of my daughters that are now in college participated in AP courses when they were in high school. And to me, the experience that the student gets just in being prepared for college-level coursework far outweighs the just getting a score on that test. So I don't feel that we're putting them in these courses just to get those test scores.
Mm-hmm. And well, what is the International Baccalaureate as opposed to the AP? I mean, what's the difference?
Well, there are several schools in our state now that participate in that program. They're usually the IB courses are in 11th and 12th grade, and 9th and 10th has pre-IB courses. And you get, it's a program that is, of course, international. And one of our high schools has just been in that program 2 years now. And they're some of the same courses, but the terminology varies. And really, it's a continuum of courses, not one isolated course like these AP courses are in biology or U.S. history or English language and composition.
Pam Heath, thanks so much for joining us today. Pam Heath is coordinator of the AP incentive grant for Lenoir County Schools. Ted Fisk, Pam Heath was talking about the benefit even for her own daughters in terms of college and how they view the AP test. Some colleges at least are changing their view of AP tests or the value they place on that. Is that correct?
That's right. Harvard, for example, used to accept either a 4 or a 5 as the score. The APs are scored on a scale of 1 to 5. So 5 would be like an A, the equivalent of an A, 4, a B, 3, a C. And so colleges vary in their criteria for what they will grant either advanced placement or actual credit. Now, theoretically, Harvard says that a significant number of its students, if they really wanted to, could take their 5s on AP and graduate in 3 years. Not very many do, though. Most students tend to see it as a way of getting advanced standing, and then they'll normally spend the 4 years.
Since we've started talking about how colleges are viewing AP results on applications, let's introduce into the conversation Jerry Lucido, who's Vice Provost for Admissions and Enrollment Management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Thanks for being with us, Jerry.
Good afternoon.
So, are colleagues at other institutions or UNC? I mean, what's the view there of AP courses?
Well, Ted's right. It really varies based upon the institution. And one of the interesting things about AP is that as colleges look at whether they'll give credit or not, they really assess, you know, what's the level of performance and information mastery that we really have in our own classrooms, and is AP demonstrating that? If AP indeed demonstrates that, then a campus will often give credit, and that's why you'll see in our case, for example, some places will give credit for 5s on the AP exams, and in other courses will give credits for 4, and very rarely do we give ever credit for a 3. And I think some colleges go away from it in a philosophical standpoint. You know, maybe the curriculum isn't matched exactly, but also, you know, the whole idea of credit with AP is a nice thing, and it's an incentive. But what you heard from Pam, I think, is probably the most important thing, and that is it's really about preparation for college and the kind of thinking that you have to do and the kind of pace that we expect in college. And so, you know, sometimes if you just concentrate too much on the credit given part of it, you lose the general idea in the first place.
And we've got a lot of calls, and I definitely want to get college into the conversation. Quickly, though, Jerry Lucido, I'm just curious, how does the college admissions officer rate or measure the level of or quality of work versus when they're just looking really at test results or scores?
Yeah, well, I would start with arguing with the premise that we don't just look at the scores. In fact, that's not the way we do admission at all. And we're moving, and many colleges and universities are moving very much away from any sort of rote admission practice where we read these files very carefully. But it's true that we use AP as an indicator that the AP designation on a high school transcript, along with the International Baccalaureate, which you heard Pam Heath talk about, mm-hmm. as a designation of some of the finest courses that students can take in high school, and then as we evaluate the strength of a curriculum, the rigor of a curriculum, how much a student was willing to challenge him or herself, AP and IB tends to stand out among other options, though they're not the only ways to demonstrate right. that.
Okay, let's take a call now. Carrie is on the line. Carrie's a Duke professor, is that right?
That's correct.
Hi, Carrie, what's on your mind?
Yes, currently I'm the chief faculty consultant for the AP Government and Politics program. Prior to this position, I chaired the committee that actually wrote this exam. I did that for about 5 years. And I like the last two callers' comments about the course. I think if I can speak for government only, and let me say, and I'm speaking for myself and not ETS or the College Board, that it's a rigorous course in government and politics. And I would challenge any university, including Harvard, to give the exam to the students who've had their introductory courses at the university and then judge the exam. Most of the courses I've seen, and I've spent a lot of time with the high school teachers in this course, the high school teachers do a better job of teaching the course. They do a better job than what I do when I teach the course. For one reason, their classroom size is much smaller than when I taught Intro to American Government at UNC, where I did my undergraduate. I was 450 students in the class. The AP is a rigorous curriculum, and the creativity and the performance of the teacher varies, of course, but I like the program. I think it's a great program.
Kerry, thanks for the call. Ted Fisk, Kerry speaking very vociferously for the rigors of the AP.
Yes, and I think from the College Board's point of view, they would make the point that the tests and the curriculum that goes with it are developed by high school teachers and college professors such as Kerry working together. I think readers, listeners should also understand that you don't necessarily have to take the course in order to take the exam. About two-thirds of the students who take the course take the exam, but a third or so don't.
And if you just take the exam,
you can also come in and pay your $82, I think it is, and simply take the exam and get the credit. So people may differ over whether that's a worthwhile activity or not.
Mm-hmm. And is that $82 price tag shutting some people out of even the opportunity?
Well, it does. But there are tuition remission programs. The College Board, will not charge low-income students. But it's not always clear from the website that low-income students can get this.
Well, let's take another call. Sue from Greensboro, I think you have a different take on how helpful AP courses are, Sue?
Well, I think they're very helpful because my son was very smart, and I really appreciated all the AP courses. But one of the problems he's had is he took 7 AP exams and failed the French. But he's at Chapel Hill now, and he got 18 months worth of credit for his core courses from his AP exams. So, you know, that was like, wait, that's great. But one of the problems seems to be, since he wants to go into the School of Business, he's been told he has to be at Chapel Hill 2 years before he can get into the School of Business. So then you're thinking, well, has he just got to keep himself busy for 2 years taking classes that he didn't need? Because he had these AP exemptions.
Right, he's got enough credit, but he's still going to be required to spend the allotted amount or the required amount of time.
Well, yeah, that's right. So, you know, you feel you're getting all those credits and you feel that you're, you know, going to get them through quicker, which is what you believe and what you think and what they've gained. But then you find that it's not going to be quicker to get on to graduate school because you've got to, you know, keep busy.
Right. Sue, let me take that question to Jerry Lucido of UNC Chapel Hill. Is this a predicament that you've seen other AP, you know, or other students get themselves into, even though they have a lot of AP credit?
Well, first of all, thank you for kicking it to me. I appreciate that, and I'm happy to respond to Sue's point. First of all, we're not picking on her son. I will tell you that the philosophy here at Chapel Hill is that all students go through our general college and receive a liberal arts education before they move on to business or any of the other any of the other professional schools. I don't know that it's a predicament. I think some students have the goal of graduating early and with AP. But as Ted's already pointed out, most students, by far the majority of students who take AP, use it to round out their experiences. That is, to use it to take those credits, have them available, skip over introductory courses, which may in some cases be large and in other cases maybe something they've already handled, and to actually go more in depth into the areas of study that we want them to master, or to study abroad, or to do internships, and to fundamentally make themselves more competitive. And I guess what I would say to Sue and her son, if I had a chance to meet him, would be, you know, let's explore how we can make you more competitive, both for the business school and for life after.
And Anthony Clay, you've been hanging on the line with us. I appreciate it. Anthony Clay is a college counselor at the Carolina Friends School in Durham, and I wanted to ask you, since Carolina Friends has decided not to offer AP courses anymore, does that have anything to do with a decline in the value that colleges are placing on these in terms of applications?
Not for us, Rusty, because Carolina Friends has never offered the AP curriculum. We've graduated seniors since the 1970s, and so it's never been a part of our curriculum, although there are certainly, as you've noted, a number of schools across the country that are either dropping the AP curriculum or certainly reassessing the advisability of offering that kind of program. So for us, we've never been in that position, and we're fortunate that Jerry and his colleagues at UNC Chapel Hill and admission officers at other colleges are willing to look at the curriculum that we do offer and assess our students as individuals within the context of the school setting. And so as a result, our students have had great success in achieving acceptance at the colleges of their choice.
We'll take a call in a sec, but Ted Fiske, you wanted to jump in here?
I was interested that Sue said her son had taken 7 AP courses, if I recall correctly, mm-hmm. which is a good, ambitious program, and it sends out the signal that colleges want to hear that I'm trying to take the most challenging courses I can.
Is there a but coming?
Yeah. When I talk to parents and college-bound students, the question I always get is, how many should I take, and how hard should I push it? The general rule of thumb among the high school counselors is if you're going to get, it's better to get a B in an AP course or a 4 than to get an A in a regular course. But if you're going to get a 3 or a C, you're probably pushing your luck. So high school students have to make this judgment. You know, I want to show that I want to be challenged, but I don't want to push myself so far that I'm just not going to do well in it.
So students are learning how to hedge their bets way. Let's take a call. Linda from Pinehurst is on the line. Hi, Linda.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks. What's on your mind?
What I want to ask of your panelists is, does the AP courses and teaching to the test actually serve the student, or does it serve the school better? The reason I ask that is I'm from Moore County, and last year we had a big blow-up where the mm-hmm. superintendent was actually paying kids who would test good on the SATs to take the scores and paying others who would not test good not to take the test. And I'll take my answer off there.
All right, thanks, Linda. We'll go around with this one. Let's start with Anthony Clay at the Carolina Friends School.
Well, I appreciate Linda's concern, and I think that the AP designation represents a convenient measure of credibility, but the Moore County example demonstrates that it may be misleading in some cases. It may be misleading because of the school setting. It may be misleading because of the individual course. It might even be misleading because of the particular exam. As Ted noted earlier, not all AP exams are created equal, and so AP English Language and Composition might be much stronger than AP Chemistry or Calculus, for example.
Ted Fiske, any veracity to her?
This is Linda raises a good concern, because schools are manipulating scores and data to make themselves look good. What the College Board has done in its ratings of schools in this respect is to change from saying what percentage of your students who take the test get high scores, which can be, you can improve that percentage simply by eliminating the number of students or lowering the number of students who aren't going to do well and discourage them from taking the test. So what they're now asking is, how many of your students get at least a 3? on at least one AP test. So they've been aware of this, and they're trying to change the incentives.
Jerry Lucido?
Yeah, thanks for letting me jump in. I want to address one of the things that your caller mentioned specifically is, do the students benefit? Because, you know, anything can be manipulated, of course, but do the students benefit? It's really clear, to go back to the point I think that Duke professor made, that these are college-level courses, that they're rigorous, that they cover a great deal of material, just like our college-level courses do, that they demand mastery of that material, and that they demand critical thinking and self-expression, which is generally a part of the of all exams of APs. You know, they're not perfect for everybody, but do they benefit students who take them? There's no question that they do, as long as that they're taught in the manner in which they're intended to be taught.
Gail from Raleigh's on the line. I think you've got another question about benefit, but economic benefit, is that right?
Well, a comment, really. I took a whole bunch of AP classes in high school, and I absolutely loved them. I loved the program. But to me, it wasn't so much concern about getting into college. It was getting through college efficiently, and it really saved me a lot of time, money, and grief because I clept out of almost all of my general ed requirements, and I could go right to the meatier classes.
So, and fill me in on how it saved you money, just by not purchasing credits that were kind of unnecessary?
Yeah, precisely, because it meant I got more out of my college experience. I had a four-year scholarship, so I actually went all 4 years, but I didn't have to waste time or tuition on an introductory freshman government class or something, because I already had that social science requirement, and so I could go into something a little bit more deep.
Great. Gail, thanks so much for the call. Jerry Lucido, did Gail get the work the system right?
Well, the system is supposed to work for individuals, so Gail worked it right for Gail. Mm-hmm. And as we pointed out before, the students today, you know, they're very much, first of all, they very much like their college experience. Some of them are in a hurry to get out. Others are delighted to stay as long as possible. But the theme that we see most often from students taking APs and bringing in credits is that they find ways to enrich their experience and to actually make themselves more competitive for graduate schools by doing so.
Okay, we have just about 10 seconds. Ted Fisk, we're not talking about the slow death of the AP course here, because a lot of schools are still offering them, right?
No, what's impressed me from the conversations and the call is that in some ways we're going back to the original purpose of the AP, and that was so students in elite schools wouldn't have to repeat material when they got to college. What Jerry was just talking about says that this is now being democratized, and a lot of students are getting better college educations because of it, and that really is a good sign.
Thanks, Ted Fisk. Ted Fisk is an education writer and author of The Fisk Guide to College. Thanks also to Jerry Lucido, Vice Provost for Admissions at UNC Chapel Hill, and thanks to Anthony Clay, Carolina Friends School. Coming up, Raleigh architect Frank Harmon shares his appreciation for the Dog Trot House. Stay with us. This is The State of Things. I'm Rusty Jacobs. When architect Frank Harmon looks at a cathedral, he sees a shed, and in a shed, he sees a cathedral. That's just one way of saying that the grandest buildings must also have functionality, and the most practical can be constructed with grace. Frank Harmon has spent much of his career observing the humble lines of sheds, barns, farmhouses, and porches in rural North Carolina, and he incorporates much of what he sees into his original architecture. He's won a number of awards for his work, most recently a Business Week Architectural Record Award for his iron studio at Penland School in North Carolina. He's now at work on a new visitor's center for the North Carolina Botanical Garden. And as part of our series on people and their jobs, he's stopped in to our studio today, and he's right here now. Thanks so much for joining us, Frank Harmon.
Thank you. It's good to be here, Rusty.
And we're taking your calls at 1-877-962-9862. I'd like to get right into that the philosophy of yours, looking from at cathedrals and sheds. And start by telling me, what have you learned from a cathedral?
Well, what I've learned from a cathedral is that a building can give us not only a roof over our heads and keep us warm, but it can do something much more important. It can nourish the spirit. And we think of cathedrals as holding places for the spirit, because in our society where so many things change, a cathedral with its presence in a city, and I don't only mean cathedral, I mean churches, other public buildings can have this function, give us a place that we can, in a sense, have our collective memory about what's really important about our place here on earth and how do our buildings represent that.
But you also have to have a place to put your tools, right? And I'm guessing that's the shed. And what's and what is the shed beyond just a storage place?
Well, sheds are some of our most noble buildings, in my opinion. If I drive across the state of North Carolina, the buildings that attract me are the ones that are off the main roads, the barns, in particular tobacco barns, the country churches, the small cottages or bungalows that sharecroppers might live in. Why they're important is that they're built usually without architects. They're built with very few materials, the materials that are at hand. They have to relate to the place they're built because, in a way, the survival of either the animals or the people living in the houses depends on them getting good ventilation, breeze, drainage, and often views. So they're buildings in a way that are elemental, and they have the most basic qualities of what makes good architecture embodied in them.
You've written about how there was a time when structures were at peace with their landscape, like farmhouses. And you write, for example, about old farmhouses along U.S. 64 speaking as eloquently about Southern culture as bluegrass, music, clay pots, or storytelling. I wonder if you can expand on that for us.
Absolutely. And you can drive along 64 today and still see some of those buildings. As I've said, these buildings were put in place out of necessity. What the person building them was trying to create was a shelter for his family or for his farm animals, a shelter that would be safe, that would be cool and pleasant in the summer, could be warm in the winter. And if you look at all the details of it, the way materials were placed one against another, it has the same sense of craft and beauty that you might find in the way a banjo player plays his instrument or a potter throws a pot. Very carefully crafted.
Without needing to kind of seal the windows and turn up the AC in the summertime. And I mean, that's something else I've read about where buildings used to be constructed in a way that they just naturally helped the inhabitant deal with the heat or the cold.
And it was very direct. Our relationship to the building and to the climate was very direct. Air conditioning has brought about an immense change in the way that we think of architecture and buildings in the landscape because it's allowed us to be independent of the climate. Unfortunately, this means that many buildings are now independent of their site and their place. They're self-contained and refer only to themselves. And it's led to some real problems in the way that we think of inhabiting cities.
Mm-hmm. What problems?
Because buildings can be self-contained and air-conditioned, they only have to relate to themselves, and we're seeing a growing tendency to create a sprawl, not only of houses, but of commercial buildings that are freestanding, usually surrounded by parking with no relationship of one building to another. If I could contrast that to, for example, the campus of UNC, the old campus of UNC, here buildings not only relate to each other, but they create outdoor spaces that in many ways are more important than the buildings themselves because these are the places where generations of students have gathered and rubbed shoulders with each other and where their collective memories are.
Is this something you're going to be talking about? I know you're going to a conference about livable cities, is it?
Livable cities in Charleston. And I'm going to talk about how we can use patterns of buildings in more traditional settings and cities to create 21st century buildings in those same cities.
Mm. You say you want your architectural designs to have both a soul and a conscience. And
yes.
I'm wondering, how can a building have either of those things?
Well, it can have a soul because it can lift us above those everyday concerns that we have about function and pragmatism and where to put the tools and store the galoshes. It can have a conscience because buildings and architecture are some of the greatest users of energy and natural resources in our culture. Just for example, our buildings that we build in North America today use about half the energy that we create in North America. They use about a third of the wood that's harvested and about a quarter of the fresh water. Those are very large figures, and clearly if we want to continue to live on the earth in a more sustainable way that respects the environment, we can do something about those, and that's what I would call dealing with the conscience of architecture. How can we build more responsibly with resources that are finite?
Well, do you have any specific examples from designs of your own of both how you put soul into something and how you built it or designed it conscientiously?
Well, a building that we created about 5 years ago is the North Carolina Pottery Center in Seagrove, North Carolina. It's a place where families have been throwing pots for over 200 years continuously, the same families. And we wanted to create a museum and a visitor center that would introduce people from all over the country to this region. To do it, we placed a series of small wooden buildings informally around a grove of oak trees on a hillside. And we lit the inside of the building with a monitor roof that allowed daylight to filter in and light the pots. We also put large windows in the building so you could look out and see the hillside where the clay was dug traditionally to make these pots. That's why the potteries are there, because of the clay in the soil. All of this created this seamless blend of buildings and pottery and landscape that captured what we thought of as the soul of this region where these families had been toiling for so long. The conscience comes in the fact that because we had that monitor roof, we're lighting it with daylight. We don't need electricity. We used wood that was cut from forests nearby and sawn in local sawmills. So we were also very conservative of materials.
We have a caller online. Let's go ahead and take a call. Wendy from Henderson. Hi, Wendy.
Hi.
Hi, what you calling about?
Well, I moved to Henderson after living in Seattle and North Idaho, where your lives are really run by the rainy weather and the snowy weather. And I moved to a home with a formal living room and dining room, but there's no place for the kids to do their projects or put their backpacks and their rollerblades and their sporting goods. And when I look at houses that were built around 20 years ago, that seems to be the common thread, is it's all formality and no function. Are you there?
We're here. No, that's great,
yeah.
Wendy.
We've already remodeled the kitchen, and now I'm getting ready to do a great big mudroom and workshop for the kids and myself to do all those projects. But houses 20 years ago, I guess, in my section, weren't made for function but for formality, I think.
Mm. Well, Wendy, let me take your comments to our guest, Frank Harmon. Thanks so much for calling. Do these comments or observations resonate with you, Frank? And do you have any suggestions for her as she considers what changes to make to her home?
Well, first of all, I would say that the design of houses is under tremendous pressure from the real estate industry and also the suppliers of building materials who furnish what the house is made of, to build the houses in certain predictable ways, to, for example, have a living room, even though our living patterns have changed, to still have a living room, to have a formal dining room, even though most folks that I know use their formal dining rooms two or three times a year. So there's a lot of pressure to do it this way for what's called resale value. I would say to the caller that the most important thing she can do is to trust herself and to make a house for herself that suits her needs and her activities, because that's going to add more to her life than anything that we can talk about, the resale value of a living room that's hardly ever used. Another thing that I've always admired about farmhouses, for example, is that a farmer never built more than the family needed, and the rooms that were built were absolutely usable for whatever they were provided for, whether it was a living or dining or taking care of suckling pigs.
And what happens if suddenly the farmer has more children? Just to add on
adds on another room. That's one of the beautiful things about these old wooden farmhouses in North Carolina. You can see how they've been added to for generations, and they grow out into the landscape in a manner that's organic and I think quite beautiful.
Have you considered alternatives to what I'm guessing you see as an outdated room, like the dining room in some suburban homes? I mean, are there alternatives to traditional structures?
Very much so. I think, first of all, it's important to think of a house not as rooms but as experiences. The experience of dining, either alone or with a family or friends, the experience of gathering, whether it's around a fireplace or to watch the Super Bowl, and what sort of spaces does one need for that? And in many cases, we've, in designing houses, have been suggesting to owners that they make one room that's at least half the size of the house. And this is a room where many things can happen over the course of a day. That room may have smaller niches or alcoves that come off of it where one could, for example, leave a puzzle, or in another niche, children could do homework. In another part or an alcove could be the kitchen, so that what's created is this large space where many things are going on that's actually much closer to a pattern that we call the farmhouse kitchen.
Mm. You also talk of a love for dog trot houses, am I right? Where
yes.
does that fit? Tell us what a dog trot house is.
Well, a dog trot house was a typical house that we see the first examples of, built in North Carolina in the 1700s. And basically, it's two rooms that are about 16 feet square. And between these two rooms is an open porch. And one roof covers all three things. I think it's called a dog trot because a dog could trot through it. Well, what it's there for is to provide breeze and cross ventilation and a covered open air space where the family could live in an era before air conditioning, before electricity, in comfort and have both good light and a pleasant place to live. It still makes a very good pattern for a house today.
This is a structure that's common to this area?
Yes, and to much of the South. It was very common in the South where the controlling issues were temperature and humidity.
Is your love of this kind of Southern architecture, are you from the South? I'm just wondering, is there any connection to where you originated?
Oh, very much so. I grew up in Greensboro, and I went to college in Europe, and when I returned, in a sense, I rediscovered what was really valuable about the farms and the places that I used to play in as a child.
Hmm. And what was it? What is the importance that you remembered or that rediscovered?
That they have an appropriateness and a sense of authenticity that is very important to us today. We live in a digital age, an age of immense amount of information, and we travel very freely. And I love all of those things. I wouldn't give up my cell phone or my laptop or my automobile. But at the same time, I think there is a danger that we lose, because we're in touch with the whole world, a sense of our own particular world where we live. And that's why I think the lessons that traditional chapels and farmhouses can teach us are about authenticity.
I think we have time for just one more call. Lori from Mooresville. Hi, Lori.
Hi, this is Lori Todd, Eric, and Greg from Mooresville.
Okay, and what are you calling about?
Hi, Frank.
Hi, Laurie.
I want to know how or if you incorporate your sense of humor into your architecture.
Thanks, Laurie. I'm guessing, Frank, you know who this person is. Tell us about that, and then tell us what your answer to the question is. Thanks, Laurie.
Well, Laurie and I have known each other for about 10 years. We're both faculty in the UNC system. I'm at NC State, and she's at Chapel Hill. Humor, I think, is one of the most important qualities in life, and certainly I like to see it in architecture, in the way that humor often means taking something that's ordinary and giving it a slight twist and making it unexpected. And I love to do the same sort of thing in architecture. Several years ago, a client asked me to make a house for them at the coast that set in this beautiful natural garden. And instead, I did do the house in this beautiful natural garden, but I put a garden on the roof of the house at the same time, which I thought was an interesting twist. And that's part of the house that they love very much.
How hard is it to get the that much sod on top?
Well, as a matter of fact, gardens on top of the houses are very popular now. They're one of the more sustainable ways that we can build, because they collect rainwater. They prevent the building from becoming a heat island. They insulate the house from changes in temperature. So many of the sustainable buildings that we're building now do have sod, or what we call green roofs.
Frank, we have just about 20 seconds left. I'm wondering if, I know that's important to you to teach your students about cooperating with the builder, right?
Yes.
Tell us about that.
Well, You know, we talked earlier about the Fountainhead and Ayn Rand. There is a misconception that an architect is a loner and an individual and a person who sort of ramrods his or her will on clients. That is not true at all. Architects are listeners, first of all, and good observers. And architects have to work with groups of people. You can't even build a picnic bench today without working with three other people. So contractors are like partners with architects to realize the vision.
Great. Thanks, Frank Harmon. Frank Harmon is an architect and professor at the College of Design at North Carolina State University, and that is the state of things for today. Thanks so much for listening. If you have a comment about our show, drop us an email here at sot@wunc.org. Support for the state of things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. I'm Rusty Jacobs.